From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In recent years, art made it onto the business pages as prices soared, and onto the front page as the dispute developed over government funding of controversial art. On this edition of Fresh Air, we discuss art in the 90s with Jed Pearl, who writes about art for The New Criterion, The New Republic, and Vogue. Also today, we meet actor Daniel Stern. He co-stars with Billy Crystal in the new movie City Slickers, and he's the voice of the adult Kevin on The Wonder Years. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers some of the performers in the 60s who tried to copy Dylan's success by copying his sound. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Officials in Moscow say that overall turnout appears to have been high in today's first-ever direct election for the presidency of the Russian Republic. 4 hours before the polls were scheduled to close in the last of Russia's 11 time zones, officials estimated the turnout at close to 70%. Early returns from the Soviet Far East showed Boris Yeltsin ahead by as much as 84%. There are five other candidates for the post, though, including former Soviet Prime Minister Nikolai Ryzhkov. It's not clear whether Yeltsin can win a clear majority in the first round of voting. The Russian elections also feature a referendum in Leningrad. Voters will decide if they want to change the city's name back to St. Petersburg. More from the BBC's Kevin Connolly in Leningrad.
In the wave of popular grief which swept Russia when Lenin died in 1924, there was a determined, although ultimately unsuccessful, move to rename Sunday in his honor. In the end, it was the country's second city, previously St. Petersburg and briefly Petrograd, which became his greatest monument. Leningrad, a graceful European-style city built on Baltic marshland by Tsar Peter the Great, has long been one of the Soviet Union's most politically radical centers. It was as Leningrad that the city endured and outlasted the Nazi siege during the Second World War. Communists argue now that it's the memory of the casualties of that long battle, and not merely Lenin himself, who are commemorated in its current title. Pragmatists say simply that changing the name of a large city with a population of millions would be expensive and inconvenient. Opinion polls suggest that the people of the city are more or less evenly divided.
The BBC's Kevin Connolly. A Kurdish rebel leader called on the United States today to lend more moral and economic support to the Kurds' efforts toward autonomy. Jalal Talabani's remarks came at the conclusion of the Socialist International Conference being held in Istanbul, Turkey. Laura LeCornu reports.
Mr. Talabani said his people are grateful for the United States' role in safeguarding the lives of thousands of Kurds after their failed uprising against the Iraqi army. Now, however, the Americans are only supporting us with words, he said. We need moral and political support to keep adequate pressure on the Iraqi government to reach an agreement with the Kurds. Talabani also called for financial support in rebuilding Iraqi Kurdistan. The Kurdish leader said the Europeans have been more sympathetic to the Kurdish problem from the beginning of the refugee crisis. Talabani also added that he does not believe an agreement with the Baghdad government for an autonomous Kurdistan can be reached soon. For National Public Radio, I am Laura LeCornu reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 24 points today to close at 2,962. This is NPR News. Secretary of State James Baker and his deputy, Lawrence Eagleburger, pressed Congress today to continue giving China favorable trade status with no conditions. Eagleburger told the House Ways and Means Committee that any attempt to impose conditions on China will lead to the cutoff of the relationship. Congressional critics of the China trade policy want to deny most favored nation status unless China improves its human rights record. Secretary Baker told a Senate panel that the Bush administration is taking other measures to encourage China to improve human rights. A measure that would have speeded up the removal of roadside billboards failed today in the Senate. Those opposed to the amendment, which was tacked on to the 5-year surface transportation bill, argued that the proposal violated the Constitution and would lead to massive job loss. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Nevada Democrat Harry Reid says the measure would kill a legitimate business. The amendment would have given states the power to take down signs that don't meet zoning requirements without any payment to the owner. Instead, the compensation would be permission to take down the sign gradually over a period of years. Reid argued the measure was in violation of the Fifth Amendment. He read the slogans from old Burma Shave billboards and said a part of history would be lost. The amendment sponsor, Senator John Chafee of Rhode Island, said his aim was to remove almost 100,000 billboards along the interstate highway system. His measure also would have put a moratorium on new billboards and prohibited the removal of trees or bushes that block the view of the signs from the highway. The Senate continues to negotiate the most controversial part of the overall transportation bill, how states divide up highway project dollars. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar said today that the United Nations is prepared to set up camps for Shiite Muslim refugees in southern Iraq. The assurance came as Iran continued to charge that the Iraqi government is preparing a massive attack against the Shiites. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jed Pearl, is an art critic in the art capital of the world, New York. And as Pearl has observed, New York is the center for all aspects of art, the making of it, as well as the promotion and buying and selling of it. And that makes for a situation both exhilarating and oppressive. In his museum and gallery reviews, Pearl writes about his personal response to the art, while also getting at the larger issues in contemporary art and the social, political, and economic pressures under which art is made and shown. Pearl writes for The New Criterion, The New Republic, and Vogue. His reviews are collected in his new book, Gallery Going. Pearl says the time has come to stop looking to the museums for guidance on contemporary art.
Museums have become institutions that have very close ties with the corporations and are very concerned with attendance figures, with building programs, with blockbuster shows. And the museums have their own agenda now, which is not necessarily the agenda of art. Contemporary art goes along at its own pace, at its own rhythm. Contemporary artists develop slowly. Artists may not do anything exciting for the first 10 or 20 years of their careers, and then just burst out with something incredibly exciting. And the real rhythm of artists who are working day by day in their studio, that is not a rhythm that our increasingly institutionalized museums can tie into or connect with. So you get museums that are constantly looking for the next trend, the next blockbuster, the next innovation. They need one next fall. They need one in 6 months. And they tend to be out of sync with what is really going on in the art scene.
This bottom line that you're describing, where museums have to do this kind of thing to bring in a lot of people to balance the books, do you think that that's about survival? Because museums, like so many art institutions, are really struggling for money now.
Museums are struggling for money. Museums have also gotten very tied into the corporate mentality of you must grow or you die. And what has happened is that museums are afraid to say, we're just going to stay the way we are. And museum going becomes a crazy experience. You go to the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., you go to the East Wing to the blockbuster show, you can't get near the paintings. And yet you walk a few steps over to the West Wing, to the permanent collection, and you're alone. You can spend an afternoon looking at masterpieces by, you know, Da Vinci, Rembrandt, in the most marvelous conditions. And yet people are pushed and pumped into these blockbuster situations.
You know what you get into when you're discussing, you know, blockbuster shows and crowds that turn up for it and so on? It's you can get into the elitist versus populist argument. You know, you can make the argument that these blockbuster shows end up finally being more democratic than the other shows because they do draw the kind of people who wouldn't ordinarily go to a museum. And that's a good thing.
Well, you ask people who have come out of the Degas show or the Gauguin show in Chicago or New York or Washington, okay, how they felt. And most of them say, thank God I got through it. And now let's go have lunch. Populist and elitist are very funny terms. And sometimes it seems that the old-fashioned elitist museums, which never charged admission, by the way, okay, and just were open and they said, if you're inclined, come. Sometimes those places, when you look back, look a heck of a lot more populist than the new supposedly populist museums. The Metropolitan Museum of Art is very expensive to get into today. A family going on a weekend, you know, mom and dad and the kids, can spend, you know, $20 getting in the front door. 25 years ago, the Metropolitan Museum of Art did not charge admission. What's populist? What's elitist? Museums, I think, should be a bit of a haven, okay, a backwater. They should be there for everybody as libraries should be. But it should also be a free place, a peaceful place where people can make their own connections.
You live and work in New York, so you cover not only museum shows, but you're in the galleries all the time. What's the difference between the function that the museums serve in the art world and the function that galleries serve in the art world?
Well, it's the gallery world is a real kind of you know, harried, pressured environment in which a lot of things happen and don't happen, and people are always kind of looking in five directions at once.
In writing about galleries, you say that the gallery scene is crowded with frauds, clones, and mediocrities. Sounds pretty discouraging.
Some days it is discouraging. You go to a lot of galleries and you don't see anything exciting. But the follow-up, I think, to that line in the book was I talked about the surprise, the exhilaration when you do find something that you react to. And it's especially exhilarating when it's by an artist you've never heard of before, or somebody whose work you've known but you've never clicked with before. And for those of us who go to the galleries all the time, there's this excitement of reacting to things as they're happening, and reacting to artists who are reacting to our time. And when it clicks, there's nothing like it.
One of the art stories of the 80s was about how art had become a really big investment,
yeah,
and that was really making the careers of some,
yeah,
artists who were really becoming quite wealthy. And the it seems now that the bottom has dropped out of,
yeah,
the art market. What are your impressions of that? I mean, has the bottom dropped out, and how is that affecting the art scene?
The bottom has and hasn't dropped out, I would say. Prices are going down, and one hears that artists of the Sally Schnabel ilk, you know, whose prices really were pushed very high up, are being left a bit sort of floating up there. They can't get the prices, and they're a little bit stuck. But the vast sort of mechanisms of publicity and support that grow up around a scene like this, they're still in place. They're retrenching a little bit, but they're still in place. In a way, the real story of art remains in the early 90s what it was in the 80s, that we have a lot of artists who are working along, who are incredibly dedicated. You know, you hear about the glitz, the million-dollar lofts. That's such a small segment of this thing. I mean, really, art is a career that involves incredible dedication and incredible courage, because the rewards, even if you get fairly well known, are just not that great. And really, we go on in the early 90s, the stuff that it really interests me, we go on as we went on in the 80s, with artists working, trying to get their work out, hoping that people will respond, developing. And I think for the more serious and the more engaging of the people who became at least semi-art stars in the 80s, that's true too. The real work gets done despite it all.
Art critic Jed Pearl is my guest, and his pieces are collected in a new book called Gallery Going. Well, censorship and funding are among the most controversial issues in the art world now. Maybe you can share with us what your take was of the controversy over the Robert Mapplethorpe art and the Robert Mapplethorpe censorship.
Well, let me kind of take a broad look at that thing, because I think we've all heard a lot about the specifics of it. I think that sometimes we tend to judge art and society by identical sets of standards. I think sometimes we tend to think about what goes on in works of art and what goes on in society in exactly the same way. And I think when we're doing that, we're making a mistake. And I think it's a mistake that's made both on the left and on the right.
Give us an example of what you mean.
A male nude, okay, that's an erotic male nude. You hear the right wing saying, this is terrible. This can't be permitted. You hear the left wing saying, this is very, very important to show, okay, because this is something that has not been shown in art in public recently, okay? In a way, both the left and the right are saying something similar. They're saying the message is, how does this relate to society? What does this say about the culture? How does it fit into the culture?
Looking at it purely as message.
Right. And my feeling is that one of the marvelous things about art is that it's a kind of free parallel universe. Okay, it's a place where we can react and respond to what's going on in all kinds of ways that are crazy, that would be inappropriate on the street. Okay, and on questions of censorship, I sometimes find myself saying, I am absolutely against censorship. If the NEA peer review panel has voted money for a Mapplethorpe show or a Mike Kelly show at the ICA in Boston, we give the money. That peer panel says this is good, and therefore it should be shown. On the other hand, at the same time, I feel perfectly free to say, as works of art, these particular things happen not to satisfy me, okay?
But it's not because you're shocked at the subject
exactly.
matter.
Exactly. And I think, one of the things that has troubled me in the last year is that I think liberals, I think of myself as a liberal, have kind of felt so caught in the middle that they've been afraid to say what they think.
Do you think that one of the after effects of the right wing's attack on controversial art is that people are becoming more interested in art with a controversial message at the expense of art that isn't politically relevant?
I think that's definitely true. A landscape painter is probably going to have a harder time getting an NEA grant today than somebody with controversial subject matter. That's not to say that the work with controversial subject matter doesn't deserve the grant. Subject matter is a real issue in art, and people do react to it, okay? And that's as it should be. When these issues get so overheated and you have people sort of at extremes lobbing things against one another, one of the tragedies is that the kind of complex experience that art, looking at art, is just gets lost. That's what we're really in this thing for those complex experiences that enlarge our sense of what's going on right now.
Does anything shock you anymore? And how do you weight that in terms of the value of the art, if it does shock you?
Well, look, what I look for when I go to the galleries is a feeling in the gut. It's a funny kind of feeling. It's a feeling that the art is pulling you toward it. I can't explain it better than that. Shock can be a part of that pull. Something is weird, disturbing, and that becomes part of the pull. But, a lot of things that are shocking, new subject matter, of course you're pulled in for a minute, but then I find that quickly I'm leaving the gallery. I'm not pulled back. On the other hand, there are other shows that on the surface don't look that exciting or shocking. But, I leave the gallery, I go to the elevator, and then I find myself going back. I just want to take a little bit more in.
If you're just joining us, my guest is art critic Jed Pearl, and he writes for The New Criterion, for The New Republic, and for Vogue, and a collection of his pieces from the mid to late 80s is in the new book Gallery Going. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is art critic Jed Pearl, and he has a collection of pieces called Gallery Going. Now, Jed Pearl, you write for The New Criterion, which is an art journal. You also write for Vogue and for The New Republic. Aside from The New Criterion, you're really not writing for the art magazines.
No.
Is that a conscious decision?
I used to write for the art magazines. It happens that I have found that I have maximum freedom writing in different kinds of places. No, it's not a conscious decision, and I think there are good things that appear in the art magazines, and the art magazines give a lot of exposure to a lot of artists who really need it. But I also do find it exciting to try to get a message about the art scene out beyond the artists. It's always wonderful when somebody who's into something else says, you know, they read you and they responded. They may not have even known precisely or specifically the artist you were talking about, but they got a sense of what you were getting at, and they felt an affinity for that.
I wonder if you think the art magazines often use the language of specialists to discuss art, and if that's not a language you're interested in using.
More and more, the art magazines do use a very specialized and increasingly academic language, that language of sort of academic theory, post-structuralism, deconstruction. You get that a lot now in the art magazines. What you get less and less of in the art magazines is direct observation, straight description of things. And it's very unfortunate, and it turns people off. One of the things that I really think we need desperately in the art world is more people who, if they're in New York or San Francisco or L.A., say, all right, I'm going to take this afternoon and I'm going to go to galleries. Galleries are wonderful. They're free entertainment. And you can just spend an afternoon and go. You go to 15 or 20 places. Don't be afraid of not liking things. Have your reactions. And, you know, one hopes when one writes that one will persuade a few people to do that and expand the audience.
Why do you think that so much art criticism is written in that kind of dry, difficult to penetrate, post-structuralist kind of language that is usually, I might add, often also lacking in wit and irony and fun, you know?
I think, you know, one thing that terrifies people about art is the fact that it is a personal reaction that we're dealing with. I think the jargon is often a way of denying the subjectivity of this. We live in a world that values precision, that values technology. We all use technology all the time. And I think we're both attracted and afraid of the subjective, of the ephemeral, of the impression, of the impressionistic. And I think a lot of the art writers are afraid to say, I did respond, I didn't respond. They want to give you some theory about it.
I know that a lot of people feel this way, and I know I sometimes feel this way too, that when you go to a gallery, this is what I experience sometimes. I go to a gallery, and especially if I'm looking particularly schlumpy that day, I feel like I walk in and think, she's not going to buy anything. Maybe we should ignore her. And you almost feel like a little out of place sometimes.
I would say two things about that. One thing that good dealers try to do is let you move through the place freely. And what many people may perceive as an unfriendliness is often a willingness to let you come in and go out at will. And the other thing I can tell you is there is nothing that makes an artist who's having a show happier than going in to look at the guest book. And when you go into a gallery, by all means, sign the guest book. There is nothing that makes an artist happier than seeing a few names in the guest book of people they don't know. Okay? And what makes artists happy makes dealers happy. Okay? You know, an artist walks into their show, and it can be the most elegant artist on earth who has great reviews. An artist walks into his show or her show, and there are a couple of, you know, students in, you know, dirty jeans sitting on the floor of the gallery. That artist's day has been made, because what it says is the public has come. And I really mean it. I know people are nervous about going to galleries, but people should get over it. And I might add, in New York and in other cities, all these gallery communities have gallery guides of one kind or another. Most galleries give them out free. You walk into one gallery, you get a list, they have maps in them. Take an afternoon, go, see what there is. You don't have to stay in every show for 10 or 15 or 20 minutes. If you don't like it, walk out and go to the next one. Believe me, dealers are happy that people come in.
Jed, let me ask you, when you're in a museum show, if you're with somebody, do you like to talk about the art as you're walking through the show, or are you self-conscious about that?
Self-conscious in relation to who? To the people?
No, about just like talking out loud about the art, knowing that, well, you know, in part because there's this kind of silence.
Oh, no, no, I think it's people, artists always talk about things in museums when they're there, and in fact, my wife and I are always complaining because whenever our son goes with his school, our son who's 8 goes to with his school to a museum, they're always told to be quiet. And, I mean, this is absurd. I mean, you go and you want to talk. I mean, the great thing is when you're with somebody and, you know, somebody's on those rare occasions when there is a bench in front of a painting you want to look at, which is so marvelous, you actually sit down. And you talk, and you know, sometimes you'll be talking about other things, and then you come back to the painting. And some of my greatest experiences with paintings have just been sitting on a bench in a museum with a friend, and, you know, we're kind of looking at it and not looking at it, and it changes the way you feel about the thing. That's part of what's terrible about Blockbusters. I've been in Blockbusters where they told you couldn't walk backwards, okay? And as you couldn't go back to the previous gallery to see a painting, keep moving. I have heard that said at Blockbuster shows. It's too crowded here. Keep moving. I mean, this is not what looking at art is about. If it's bad at the Blockbuster, leave, go to the permanent collection, sit down in front of a painting, and have yourself an experience. Just because that particular painting isn't being written about Newsweek that week doesn't mean it's not worth looking at.
Well, Jed Pearl, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Jed Pearl is an art critic. He writes for The New Centurion, for Vogue, The New Republic, and he has a new collection of pieces called Gallery Going, Four Seasons in the Art World. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Daniel Stern's the first to admit he's been fortunate as an actor. He never even finished an acting class, yet his first movie part was a co-starring role in the hit Breaking Away. He was in last year's big hit, Home Alone, and he's currently co-starring with Billy Crystal in the movie City Slickers. Coming up, we talk with Daniel Stern. Also, throughout rock history, hit records have led to second-rate imitations by writers and performers not nearly as talented as the originals. Rock historian Ed Ward checks out some of the performers who tried to get the sound of Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russians chose a president today for the first time in their 1,000-year history. Early returns showed reformer Boris Yeltsin leading by a large margin. NPR's Ann Gerrels has this report.
Boris Yeltsin, with his program of radical economic reform, privatization of land and industry, and greater freedom from the center, appears to have won the day, but it's not clear he has won the election. He needs 50% of the vote, and it's not certain he has garnered enough to avoid a runoff in 2 weeks. His closest opponent in the six-man race is Nikolai Ryzhkov, the former prime minister who favors a more cautious move to a market economy. Ryzhkov is widely criticized for having failed in the past, but even those who support Yeltsin are by no means sure he can succeed in the future, given the country's tremendous problems. Residents of Moscow and Leningrad also elected new mayors. Radical reformers and Yeltsin allies seem certain to win. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
India has resumed its election voting. Election officials say at least 8 people were killed today in clashes among rival party supporters. The 8 were killed in the northern state of Bihar, while stray incidents of violence were reported in other states. Turnout was subdued and estimated at about 50%. More than 100 million people, about a fifth of the world's biggest electorate, were eligible to vote today. Most of the rest will vote on Saturday. Vote counting starts on Sunday. Results are expected 2 days after that. A study in the latest New England Journal of Medicine holds out hope that a vaccine may be useful someday to treat people already infected with the AIDS virus. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
The purpose of a vaccine is to fool the body into thinking it is under attack so it will get ready to fight. That way, the body's defenses are up when the actual virus comes along. So a vaccine must be given before someone gets infected. And that's why the new study is important. It seems to show that, in the case of AIDS, a vaccine might teach the body how to defend itself even after it has come under attack by the virus. 30 volunteers received an experimental AIDS vaccine developed by Microgenesis, a vaccine made up of one tiny piece of the AIDS virus known as GP160. The vaccine appeared to be safe during the 10-month study. More important, most of the volunteers developed new immune responses to the AIDS virus. It's far too early to tell if the immune changes will actually help fight the virus, but researchers say there's now a glimmer of hope that someday a vaccine could help those infected with AIDS. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
The Philippine volcano Mount Pinatubo erupted 7 times today. The massive explosions threw gas, molten rock, and ash several miles into the air. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower. The Dow fell 24 points to end the day at 2961.99. This is NPR. The White House is stepping up lobbying efforts to extend China's most favored nation trading status. President Bush met with Senate Republicans to press his case today, and Secretary of State James Baker and his deputy, Lawrence Eagleburger, went to Capitol Hill to defend the president's position. Mr. Bush wants to continue China's most favored nation trading status for another year, but many lawmakers want to punish China for its dreadful human rights record. If the request is voted down, the president has threatened a veto. Then lawmakers would have to muster a 2/3 override vote to deny China the ranking trade status. When President Bush gives his speech tonight, he's expected to use the opportunity to criticize the Democrats in Congress for not passing his crime and transportation bill within 100 days. NPR's Mara Liasson reports that Democrats on Capitol Hill fought back in advance.
Congressional leaders say the president's 100-day deadline is irrelevant and unnecessary. It's just an excuse to bash Congress. Today, Republicans in Congress suggested that by not passing the president's crime bill, Congress was somehow responsible for thousands of street crimes. House Speaker Tom Foley said that grossly misrepresented the impact of the president's bill. President Bush's crime proposals would only affect federal prosecutions, Foley said, while 97% of all crime is prosecuted by state and local officials.
The federal government has a relatively minor role to play in criminal prosecution. The idea of increasing federal death penalty statutes as an answer to serious street crime is ludicrous.
Meanwhile, the White House is playing down President Bush's speech tonight, saying the president's speech will offer no new initiatives or new ideas. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Republican senators surprised President Bush with song and gifts today to mark his 67th birthday. After the senators' rendition of the birthday song, the president joked that the music wasn't much, but the sentiment was great. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The face of my guest, Daniel Stern, became familiar to zillions of Americans when he played a bungling burglar in last year's hit Home Alone. His voice was probably already familiar as the narrator on the TV series The Wonder Years. Daniel Stern first made his mark in coming-of-age movies like Breaking Away and Diner. But in the new movie City Slickers, he's having a midlife crisis. He co-stars with Billy Crystal and Bruno Kirby as three friends in New Jersey, nearing middle age, looking for an adventure that will help them feel young and rugged and free. They take a fantasy vacation at a dude ranch, where they go on a cattle drive and learn to do all those cowboy things they grew up watching in the westerns. I asked Daniel Stern if being a cowboy was a dream of his when he was growing up.
I didn't watch a lot of westerns. I watched Bonanza, but I think maybe American boys are divided into baseball players and cowboys, and I was probably a baseball fantasy person, you know, sports. But, doing the movie, I certainly understood what everybody was talking about. Except when the fantasy turns into reality, there you really are with the cows and the horses and the ropes and the cowboys. It's a pretty intimidating experience.
So what was the hardest thing for you to learn for City Slickers?
Well, it was a pretty physical movie. I mean, we were riding and then we were running. There are scenes where there's a stampede and we run away from that or we get swept into the river. I mean, every day was a pretty tough experience. Maybe running away from the bulls, that might have been a challenge.
You know, the movie that you made that probably the most people have seen is Home Alone. What was it like to star in a movie and have, like, the kid emerge as the superstar of it?
I've done that before. I do the show The Wonder Years on TV, and that kid took off, too. I just take these kids and I ride their coattails to superstardom. Macaulay's a great person and a great... I got plenty of recognition for my own ego, more than satisfied, my fill of stardom or whatever that is. I don't have any bad feeling about that at all. Actually, if anything, I'm too recognizable myself. And I kind of feel bad for somebody like a kid like Macaulay. That's a lot of pressure for a 10-year-old boy.
A lot of our listeners will recognize your voice as the voice on The Wonder Years, the mature version of the Kevin role. How did you get the role? I'm wondering what it was about your voice that made it seem like the right voice to be the adult version of the role Fred Savage was playing.
I read the script, and I thought this was a great writing. I mean, this writing on The Wonder Years is outstanding. And I made a tape, like a audio tape of me reading this stuff, and they picked me. I don't know why, except that maybe I was so fond of the material that I read it with a lot of heart, because I felt what was happening to the kid, and it all kind of matched up good. And they were nuts for me. What can I say?
You say that you really felt the part. Was there something about the character that you particularly identified with?
I identified with the time and the take on situations, and I mean, the good thing about it is that Kevin Arnold, I guess, is he goes one step forward and one step back, and things are modest and moderated in his life. And I liked, it wasn't a total winner kind of, or always wrapped up tight at the end in a neat sitcom package. And I thought that was really refreshing.
What are the circumstances that you record under? You don't need to be on the set or anything to do the voiceovers?
No, I go to a studio, and wherever I am, you know, I go off and do movies a lot. So, I mean, when I was doing City Slickers, I was recording in some guy's garage in Durango. He said he had a sound studio. It was the best we could find. So he had, like, this padding on the wall and stuff. And so the sound engineer from the movie and I went after work once a week or so and read the stuff. Then we moved to Santa Fe. Actually, when we moved to Santa Fe, we got there one night and they needed the tape the next day. So he and I went into my bedroom of this house that I'd rented, which I'd never been in, and recorded it in this bedroom. But it was kind of unusual because there was no, he didn't have a windscreen or there was no soundproofing or anything. So I ended up, like, I was holding a blanket over my head and the microphone was inside. Like, I made a little tent for myself and put a sock over the microphone and for the windscreen. And it was, but no one ever knew that. It came out just as good as the others.
Actor Daniel Stern is my guest. He co-stars in the movie City Slickers. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Daniel Stern is my guest. From what I've read about you, it seems like you kind of stumbled into acting.
Well, I can't exactly remember, but I was acting in high school. I was, you know, started to get the lead parts in my high school, and then happened on, if I stumbled into anything, I stumbled into the first professional job I had. I mean, I thought I was supposed to be, got a job as a lighting technician, and in fact, I got cast in the play where I then met actors who lived in New York who invited me to come up to New York and give acting in New York a try and stay with them and things. And I've been incredibly lucky. I mean, so fortunate, I don't even like to think about it. Just that I started working and got into a few plays and then got into movies and met my wife and had my kids and made more movies and worked with great directors. I mean, it's too scary to even think about.
Did you have any formal dramatic training?
No.
Did you ever feel...
No, I was in a class when I first got to New York. I was like, I think I just turned 18, and my parents kind of insisted I do something with some structure. So I took a class with Austin Pendleton at the Herbert Berghoff studio, but then Austin, in a few weeks, cast me in a play that he was directing. So I thought, well, heck, I'm a professional actor now. I don't need this. I never quite understood it, you know, because acting classes, to me, my feeling is, and this is just me, and I'm not that experienced in the classes, so maybe I never got enough out of it. But when you do a show or when you do a movie or a play, the audience has to be part of it. The audience is part of the show. They have to suspend their belief and want to go with you on the show. And I always felt like in the few acting classes I took, that or sat in and watched, that the audience was other actors, not really. It was disassociated from a show. It didn't have to do with telling a story or acting out a part. It had to do with something much more personal or or something that wasn't what I do.
Did you make a lot of B-movies early in your career?
No, I started at the top. The first movie I was ever in was Breaking Away, and it was kind of just a magical kind of run I had with that. I mean, I got into that movie, and I'd never been in a movie before, and that movie went all the way to, like, being nominated for Academy Award Best Picture, and Steve Tesich won for the Best Writer and Best Screenplay, and I never had to do really bad movies. I've done some movies that didn't work, but I didn't know how good I had it.
I think the movie that I've seen you in which you were most different than any other role of yours I'd seen, because you looked like such a derelict, was in Chud, which is short for Cannibalistic Humanoid Underground Dwellers.
Yeah, Chud, baby, yeah.
Tell
we
me
love
about making
Chud.
That movie. It's on TV
like
all the
movie.
Time. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of fun. It's always on TV.
Yeah, that was a good character. I mean, I kind of made that character up myself. My friends were all doing the movie, and they wanted me to be in it, and we all together figured out a way for a part for me, because in the original script I wasn't really in it. And I don't know, it was crazy. It was a crazy shoot. We were in the sewers of New York for 6 weeks in summer. Now that's a location. But that was kind of nuts.
Describe your character.
Oh, I ran a soup kitchen for homeless people, and a lot of the homeless were sleeping like in the subways or in the sewer system. But there had been a radioactive leak. Uh-oh. And they drank the water and turned into chuds. And I was the connector between, like the liaison between the normal people on top and the undergrounders. Fascinating characterization, I must say.
What got you acting when you were in high school? Why did you want to act?
Why did I want to act? My friend David Rosenthal was playing Tevye in our community production of Fiddler on the Roof, and I was stage managing it, and he was getting more attention. So I decided next play I'd try it. And so I got up there and danced and sang, and I got the part. And then I don't know what happened after that. I just enjoyed it. I loved the excitement of it. My mother, on the other hand, thinks that it was some sort of desperate need for attention. And maybe she's right also. I don't know.
Sounds like you're both saying the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to be, I don't know. It seemed like fun. It's great fun. I mean, there's many actors out there who aren't in movies or professional actors who are. I love that there's community theater and high school plays and Super 8 movies and people who aren't in any kind of glory position or money-making position or things like that. People do it because they love it. It's really fun to tell a story and have an audience listen to the story and go with you on it and laugh or cry or be intense or tense or on the edge of their seat or whatever you're supposed to be making them feel. People enjoy that, and not just on the professional level, and it's really exciting. And whatever that is that people enjoy watching as audience members or performing as as the performers, I'm bit by the same thing.
Daniel Stern, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Daniel Stern co-stars in the new film City Slickers, and he's the voice of the adult Kevin on The Wonder Years. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll have news today from the Soviet Union, where the election of a Russian president is taking place. It's widely expected to be Boris Yeltsin. Also, we'll hear why the sale of grain to the Soviet Union may be good or bad foreign policy, but some say it's good economic and farm policy for this country. We'll be hearing about the truth behind the Robin Hood legend and a talk with Susan Dehim. She's an avant-garde singer born in Iran, now lives in New York City, who's in the midst of an interesting transition in her career. She's now starting to sing songs that have words.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are a few people who saw Bob Dylan on this year's Grammys who'd want to sound the way he does now, but rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers a time when almost everyone wanted to sound like Dylan.
There was so much media noise on May 24th when Bob Dylan turned 50 that I didn't see much reason to add to it. After all, what's left to say about a guy who's inspired a shelf full of books already? But I did think back to the moment when the success of his weird 6-minute-long single, Like a Rolling Stone, caught the record business by surprise. Was this a trend? If so, who would be the next Dylan? The same question had been bumping around in folky circles for years. Dylan's arrival in New York early in the 60s had spawned a rash of young guitar strummers intent on proving that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. David Blue, Eric Anderson, Phil Oakes, and dozens of others chased Dylan's shadow while they grew into their own styles. And then, of course, there'd been Donovan. For a glimpse of what Bob Dylan thought of him, I recommend the film Don't Look Back. But rock and rollers, they weren't into mere imitation. They were into Xeroxing. To this day, Mouse of Mouse in the Trap swears that the sound of Public Execution was a fluke, that since he and the band were way out in Tyler, Texas, they'd never heard of Bob Dylan. Some of us find this position just a bit disingenuous. Mouse in the Traps were just the most blatant. Elsewhere in Texas, Huey P. Moe, the canny producer who'd come up with the Sir Douglas Quintet as his answer to the Beatles, found a group called the Hombres. Their reasoning was that it was the abstract lyrics the kids liked. No parking by the sewer sign, hot dog, my razor broke, water dripping up the spout, but I don't care, let it all hang out. Hanging from a pine tree by my knees, sunshine through the shade, nobody knows what it's all about, it's too much, man, let it all hang out. The record company called it Let It Out. The real title was perhaps a bit spicy for the public, and it got the Hombres a top 20 hit before they faded away. Texas wasn't the only place people were trying to figure out the Dylan mystique. Since everybody from Manfred Mann to the Byrds was doing well by recording Dylan's old songs, a New York band, the Blues Project, decided they'd look back into folk history and record a number by one of the previous new Dylans, Eric Anderson. Take me to the night on tipping, topsy-turvy, turning upside down. Hold me close and whisper what you wish, for there is no one here around. Oh, you can sing song me sweet smiles, regardless of the city's careless frown. Colors fade blazing into petal sprays of violets of dawn. It probably wouldn't have hit even if they had tuned the guitar. And out in Hollywood, a former Phil Spector sideman, a guy who'd actually hung out with Dylan, put in his 2 cents. Laugh at me, Sonny Bono said with selfless compassion, and I'll pray for you. No doubt, the discovery that they had a god in common with Sonny Bono drove many a 60s youngster into the arms of an alien oriental religion. Eventually, of course, Bob Dylan proved that his record company's advertising slogan, "Nobody sings Dylan like Dylan," was right on the money. Then he had his motorcycle accident and vanished for a while, and a whole slew of new Dylans, people like Loudon Wainwright III and George Gurdes, appeared. They're still doing it today. I think Roger Manning is a swell candidate for Dylanhood. But the sound that Bob Dylan gave us lived on for many a year, inspiring bands on both sides of the Atlantic who eventually decided to sound like themselves, which was a lot easier than figuring out what he would sound like next.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Here's Mott the Hoople with their 1970 version of a Doug Somm song done a la Dylan. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Ajiva Blytus, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm so afraid, but now I'm trying to see. I just rolled on through life till I took the time to concentrate on.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This week, the FDIC predicted that more than 400 commercial banks would fail by the end of next year. On the next edition of Fresh Air, we examine the banking crisis with Washington Post reporter Jerry Knight. Also, a talk with NPR commentator Andre Cădrescu about his new book on his return to Romania. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.